Today, a British basketball star on the brink of glory at the Paralympics. Sophie Carrigal has played basketball all over the world for Team GB, but she's never lost the thrill she felt playing her first game over a decade ago.
It is an incredible feeling, honestly, and that doesn't just start on court, that starts getting on the plane, in the changing room, putting your vest on, your heart rate's rising, your palms are sweaty, you're getting that nervous, excited energy, which I love, I thrive off that, I really enjoy that feeling, and it's an absolute honour to be representing my country.
Sophie and her teammates are ranked second in the world for women's wheelchair basketball. They have a real shot at gold in Tokyo. That's a long way from the Leeds Leisure Centre, where Sophie turned up as a complete beginner in 2012. She'd had an accident that had changed her life, and she was trying to find a way back into sport, which she'd always loved. As soon as she started playing this intense, competitive game, she knew this was it.
For me, that feeling is, you know, it's power through your arms, it's that fast pace, like hand speed by pushing the chair, manoeuvring your body. Oh, it's just electric.
From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, the story of one British Paralympian's long and extraordinary journey to Tokyo. Sophie, we're going to talk about the life-changing event you went through 11 years ago. I know you had a car crash, and then what happened after that through a whole series of twists and turns has led you to then become one of the best wheelchair basketball players in the world. But first, I just wanted to know a bit more about you and what you were like as a 16-year-old before your accident.
Oh, I was into a lot of things, but honestly, one of my favourite things was watching The X Factor on a Saturday night, getting a takeaway with my mum and dad, and we'd all sit around and watch it. I love dancing and singing, and honestly, my guilty pleasure has to be JLS. Still to this point, I would love to say that I'd fallen out of love with Aston Merigold, but I don't think I have. I think it must have been the backflips that drew me. You know, I'm a massive extrovert, so I love being around people. That's always been the case. But also, I was naturally sporty. You know, that came naturally to me.
And what sports were you into?
Oh, I absolutely loved netball. That was probably my favourite sport to play and watch. I was sort of on the path to playing for county for netball. So I was hoping that that would probably take me to that step, you know. I never ended up getting there, but I think that's mainly because I had my accident when I was 16. I'd have loved to carry on, you know, playing netball through university and all things like that. But ultimately, yeah, it's a different sport that I've taken up now.
And you've mentioned the accident. Can you tell me what happened?
So I was involved in a car accident. It was a pretty traumatic one. I was in America at the time, visiting family that I have over there. And the guy driving lost control and went straight into a tree. He was going at 60 miles an hour around a 90 degree bend. So obviously quite high speeds that we went into the tree. And ultimately I did a lot of damage internally, including breaking my back and my spinal cord, which is the disability that I have now permanently, is paraplegia. But in those first early weeks and months, I was left fighting for my life. I was bleeding internally. Pretty much all of my organs were damaged in some sort of way. And I had life-saving surgery multiple times whilst I was out in America.
God, it's a really close call by the sounds of it.
It was really close. Yeah, I'm very lucky to be alive. I was told actually when I came back to the UK, because I spent 2 months in hospital in America, until I was able to fly back home. And then I spent about 2.5 months in hospital in the UK. And the doctors here said to me that they didn't think I would have survived had I been here with just the extent of my injuries. And all those doctors for all the different parts of my body needed to be there in that moment to save my life. Whereas we don't necessarily have that same provision in the UK.
You say that, you know, you always felt very lucky to be alive and to, you know, be getting the treatment that you were having. Did your sort of spirit waver? I mean, how did you stay so positive about that experience?
It wasn't easy. You know, I suppose I come across now quite positive and very accepting of what has happened, and I can talk quite frankly about it. But in those moments, I don't think that was necessarily the case. I was definitely putting on a brave face for the people around me, you know, my mum and dad especially, proving that I would be okay. That saying, you know, fake it till you make it. I don't necessarily advise people doing that, because I think, you know, obviously talking about how you're feeling is really important. The biggest challenge for me was I was a young 16-year-old girl. You know, my life was just starting. I wanted to go to university. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life, but I knew it would be something great. You know, I'd have a great time. I'd go traveling or play loads of sport. And I just think that moment in time was pivotal as a young girl anyway, you know, going through all the turmoil that you go through as a 16-year-old, to then have this traumatic injury thrown on me as well, and to almost have to change my perceptions of who I was. You know, my identity changed. I was now a disabled girl, and I don't think I was ready to accept that yet. I sort of wanted to go back to, and this is definitely in inverted commas, like what was normal. And for me, that was, you know, being back at school with my friends. We were all going into sixth form, so it was, you were able to wear suits and heels and dress up a little bit for school. You know, I sort of felt I was missing out on that, but I just wanted to get back to it as quickly as I could, without really accepting the massive change that had happened.
How did it change the way you felt about yourself and about your body?
It made me really be annoyed at myself. As a young girl, I played so much sport. I had really like muscly legs and muscly arms, even as a young, you know, 14, 15 year old. And I used to hate it. I used to think, oh, I just want to be so skinny like all the girls at school. And actually then when I had my accident, all my muscles like withered away because I wasn't using them. And I was so, so skinny and so ill. And I was like, oh my God, is this what I was thinking that I wanted? Like, I look awful, you know? So it almost made me mad about like beating myself up, you know, earlier in my life for the legs that I had and the strength that I had as a young girl.
How did the disability change the way other people treated you?
I think I did lose some friends along the way. You know, when my accident first happened, people not knowing what to say, people not knowing if they could accept it or accept the change. But I noticed it more with the general public, you know, not my friends. I noticed getting looked at a lot more, going around in a wheelchair, obviously people are looking at you. And I think it was mainly because I was so young and people are very inquisitive, and, you know, I'd probably have been guilty of it too. You know, if there was a young girl in a chair going around a shopping centre, I'd have probably looked as well. So I never like begrudge people of doing that. And people often have kids with them who says, look, mummy, that girl's in a wheelchair. And I, you know, smile at them and I say, yes, I am. Do you want to ask any questions? The reason I'm alive is because my body was strong enough to cope with all that trauma. I've got scars all over my body and I absolutely love them. I've got one massive one that goes all the way down my stomach and then lots on either side. You know, I look like I do because I've been through a lot of trauma, and I'm proud of that. I'm proud to be on the other side of that.
How did you begin to reach the other side, as you put it? What was your recovery process like?
I would say it probably took a year, and it probably took me finding basketball to really, I guess, find myself again. And I was also lucky enough to go on a backup course. So this charity called the Backup Trust, they're amazing for people who have spinal cord injuries, and they help you sort of regain and rebuild your life, regain confidence. And I went on a course with them to the Lake District, and we were doing all types of crazy things, you know, that I'd have been doing able-bodied, so rock climbing, abseiling, horse riding, climbing up a mountain. And that was what opened my eyes actually a lot to what was still possible, and it was what I guess brought me back to sport and made me think, right, I want to get back into this. I feel like it's missing. So I just Googled the local disability sports in my area, and I was living in Leeds at the time. So luckily there was quite a few options, you know, wheelchair racing or tennis or basketball was obviously one of them. So yeah, I just went along to my first session and I was absolutely terrible at the time. I was so bad, even though I had those, you know, basic skills of being able to catch and throw and things like that. I didn't have the strength and I had no idea how to move like a sports wheelchair as well, because they're so different to the everyday chair that I use. So I just remember getting into that other chair feeling like it was an absolute alien to me, like almost like putting on a brand new pair of trainers and you just, they're not comfortable at all. So it was that moment of, oh my God, I'm so bad at this. I was like, I couldn't even shoot in like a little tiny net. And I remember watching like the more experienced players on the other court playing a proper game, like up and down the floor and going so fast and being so aggressive. I literally remember it so vividly, watching, thinking, wow, I want to do that. I want to be that good. So I just kept going back. I kept going to training, even though I was not great.
How long were you not great for? Like, how long was it difficult for?
I would say a couple of months it took to pick it up. The chair was the main thing, being able to push that and shooting from, you know, so low down into a basket that is the same height as they use in the running game. So it was building that strength up for me, really. And I think that just improved as my sort of independence in my daily life improved as well.
You've explained how hard the sport is for a beginner, and I've watched it and it looks really intense. Can you tell me a bit more about what it's like to play?
There is a lot of contact. It's meant to be a non-contact sport, but there is a lot of contact. You'll see if you watch the game, you know, you'll see a lot of wheelchairs rolling around on the floor with people in them, you know, because it is aggressive. It's so fast paced, you know, 20 seconds between each basket's really, you know, you're going back and forwards really quickly. You've got to be quite agile and obviously efficient with your movements. And yeah, it's a lot of arm strength, you know, your biceps pumping, your triceps going with that pushing movement. It's inevitably a really, aggressive sport.
And there's a classification system, isn't there, which determines where and how you play in the team. Could you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, so the classification system is there for fairness, really, to allow people with different disabilities to be able to compete on a level playing field, really. So for me, I'm paralysed from the waist down. So my classification is a one-pointer. And in wheelchair basketball, that's the lowest point that you can have. Another example is someone who's an amputee might be a four-pointer because they have a lot more control of the rest of their body, whereas I am paralyzed from the waist down, so I just have, you know, my upper body to use. And then on course at one time you can have 14 points, so made up of five people, you would have to have a mix of everybody to be able to play a lineup that was a legal lineup, so a couple of fours, maybe a couple of ones, but they all just have to add up to 14 points to play internationally.
Do you remember the particular moment on the court when you realised, actually, I'm really good at this?
Yeah, I do, yeah. maybe not really good, but I remember thinking, wow, I've just had a really good game. And it was at a junior tournament and some of the GB coaches were there. So sort of scouting, I guess, the new players, up and coming players. So I was thinking, I've got to do well. I've got to, you know, look like I know what I'm doing. And I think I scored like four or five times, which was a lot for me at that moment. And the coaches came up to me afterwards and said, you know, you've got some potential. We'd love you to come along to one of our camps so we can do some more training with you. And that was it then. I guess that it was just that bit of inspiration that GB was a potential to play for your country. It was like, wow, they're watching you. It could happen. And that was the first moment that I thought, I've played well, they've spotted me, I've got a chance here, let's give it everything.
You didn't just play for Team GB, you went on to become the co-captain of the women's basketball team, finished fourth in the Rio Olympics in 2016, and then since then you've won so many medals at some of the biggest tournaments in the sport worldwide. How has all that success affected the way that you think about yourself?
Oh, that's a great question. It has been such a ride, you know, what a roller coaster I've been on since that accident happening and then being selected for my first tournament and being in the team ever since. It's honestly such an honour. I don't think about this often, but I think if you, you know, at times like these when you're sort of reflecting back on your past life and, you know, where you've come from, it does just make me really proud that I was able to overcome such adversity and such a life-changing thing happening to me.
And it's become essentially a full-time job, right? I mean, is there funding there? Like, how does it work financially? Are the resources there that you need to do what you do and just concentrate on basketball?
Yeah, we're really lucky, actually, that we are funded by the National Lottery and UK Sport, and we can generally do most things that, you know, as a team we want to do, go abroad and compete or travel and go to training camps and have a centralised location where we train, you know, pretty much before COVID, it was Monday to Friday full time.
How did all of that affect your training? I mean, when the COVID pandemic hit early in 2020, you were probably very deep in preparation for the Tokyo Paralympics. What did your training plan look like and how did it adapt?
Well, honestly, the day that we stopped training, I'd taken a few weights from the gym, you know, home, and I was literally doing like circuits in my lounge, and that was not going to get me the best prepared for a Paralympic game. So I was very relieved when, you know, it was postponed, because ultimately it was more stressful trying to think, how am I going to prepare in my home, not playing basketball, for a Paralympic Games? Thankfully, that gave us an extra year, you know, to sort things out and, you know, for COVID to obviously be managed as best as it could. But we didn't go on court for 6 months, probably, and did a lot of home training, circuits, gym programs, yoga sessions. You know, it actually allowed us a bit of downtime as well. You know, our sport, wheelchair basketball, was so great at putting our mental well-being and that health first. It was a great approach from them, because being in a team sport and not being able to be around your team is pretty hard. You know, you can do individual skills, you know, outside on the drive, but, you know, it's not realistic, really.
Well, your boyfriend Josh Landman is also a professional athlete. What's life been like in your house together over the last year? Has he been supporting you with training and diet?
Yeah, he's great, and vice versa, me supporting him. He's just done a bike session, actually, and I was literally sat by him, like, shouting at him, come on, you can do it. So we do support each other a lot. It's nice to be in a relationship where that person fully understands your commitment to sport, because it's unsociable hours. It's, you know, we can't do things that most couples might be doing now, because I've, you know, been isolating pretty much this whole month. You know, going into Tokyo. So he's had to do the same because we live together.
What's his sport?
He's a para triathlete. So we met actually only at the start of the first lockdown. So
oh, wow.
Bit of a lockdown romance, really. We sort of put all our eggs in one basket and thought, well, either this will either be great or it won't. And, you know, it worked out absolutely more than great, because he's just an absolute diamond. And I pretty much lived with him and his mum and dad for most of lockdown. And then we started looking for a house together. So it worked out great.
Will he be going to Tokyo with you?
No, he's not, sadly. So he just missed out on qualifying himself, because he's only just really started out, you know, at this sort of the top level of the sport. He's been doing it for about 2 or 3 years now. But he will 100% be in Paris, and I just have just the highest hopes for him, because he's so dedicated to being successful. And then sadly, he can't come out even as a spectator, because nobody's allowed, which will be such a shame. I'm very used to having, you know, family and friends around when we're competing. So that'll be a bit of a change for us, for sure.
Coming up, Sophie's marathon journey to the Games reaches its climax. Sophie, the Paralympics are starting on Monday after a lot of upheaval and doubts that they'd even go ahead. It must have been such a relief for you to find out you're going to Tokyo after all.
Yeah, it was. Well, I mean, we got selected at the end of May, so I knew from the end of May that I was selected to go. But actually making it on the flight was another story, because, you know, we've got COVID that's looming over us all the time. And then the moment of watching the Olympics, and I think it becomes real at the closing ceremony of the Olympics, because then it's like, right, there's nothing else to watch. Everything's done. We're next.
It is staggering to think that it was only in 2012, before the London Olympics, that you just started getting into wheelchair basketball. And when you look back to that time, the Paralympics were in a very different place. How much do you think public perception has changed?
There were, massively. But since then, I think there was a massive spike initially after London, that the Paralympics were seen as equal. I think that's all well and good in those moments, but actually for disability sport, you don't see our sport, especially wheelchair basketball, you know, any other time, really. The coverage isn't great. You know, our even our world championships and European championships aren't streamed as well as I personally think they should be. I know I'm probably biased, but one in four people of our population have a disability, and we are not represented one in four times. You know, we're not a wheelchair sport and it's like, oh, well done for trying. No, I train as hard as an Olympian does. I'm a Paralympian and I'm proud of that. And I, you know, work hard to get there. And so for me, there's still work to be done.
And so how would it actually feel to win a medal in Tokyo?
Oh, winning a medal, a Paralympic medal, is honestly my biggest dream. It's my biggest goal in life. Obviously, gold would be the absolute pinnacle, but success for us would come in the form of a medal because we've never won one before. We've got world silver, European silver. They're the best achievements that we've had as a team so far. We came fourth in Rio, so we were that team that was just one place. You know, we missed it just by one place. So I think it just made me so much more hungry, I suppose, for what has been now 5 years of preparation into Tokyo. And I think we're ready. I think we're in a great place and quietly confident going into these games that we've got a really good chance of bringing home a medal. And honestly, I've thought about it already. Where would I put it? What would I do? Would I frame it?
Where would you put it?
I don't know. I feel like I'd need to like sleep with it for a week or something at least, just to make sure that it was actually real. Maybe I should knit something like Tom Daley did to put it in. But yeah, I mean, I'm keeping my fingers tightly crossed that success comes our way. And, you know, we've worked really hard. So whatever happens, I'm really proud of this team.
If your 16-year-old self could see you now, what would she think?
Oh, I think she'd be really proud. I think she'd be, yeah, she'd be happy and she'd sort of think, wow, it does all turn out all right in the end. Overcoming adversity is possible and living a fulfilling and happy and amazing life afterwards is also more than possible.
Sophie, it was such a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much. And obviously, we're wishing you so much good luck. We're all going to be rooting really hard for you back at home.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the support.
That was Sophie Carragill. She and Team GB will be playing their first game against Canada on Wednesday. And we'll be watching. Come on, Sophie. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Rose De Larabiti. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Archie Bland and Phil Maynard. We'll be back on Monday.